floor is now open for commentary.
I'm glad I asked you that question.
Could I ask you a question just for clarification of something, because it'll take me a while to get used to your vocabulary. So, you know, I'll reread this when I go home and I'll think about it. Why is the relationship between the special and general categories not the terms and relations of interiority? What is that not subtly issue? Since ultimately all categories are derived from the categories of interiority, as I understand, what makes it so difficult in practice, because the systematic theologian in practice uses both sets, why are we looking for this nexus? I don't understand the problem. Why it isn't settled by conclusion, ultimately?
Well, first off, you've got to consider what do categories mean in Lonergan. And this is something that that I had to work through. They don't just mean conceptual terms and relations, I don't think.
No, not okay. Conceptual, not real. They're okay. Real.
But, I mean, that's the origin of the term, categories. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, if you go back to Aristotle, you have your list.
But once you understand,
they're basically predicates.
But once you understand them, you form concepts of them, so they become categories.
Well, right? No, yes, that's okay. Well, you know, the descriptive categories in his case. For Lonergan, wants to go beyond that and talk about explanatory categories. Mm-hmm. But they're not just conceptual categories, they're, for Aristotle, they're kinds of things. They're the real kinds of things. So we step outside of it. So what I'm saying is, if you distinguish in Lonergan's way of approaching the whole issue, that you have a base, you have a spontaneous expansion, and you have categories that can either be just conceptual or real, then you're faced with asking three questions. What is the relationship between the bases? And that cannot be a conceptual relation. It's a relation between one reality and another reality. What is the relation between the expansions? Again, that we're talking about realities there. The third question is, what is the relation between the categories? Well, the categories start off as concepts, explanatory terms and relations. Now, I don't have an answer to that third question yet. But that's why I set that up, that you have to have three different kinds of questions. And the question of the relationship between the real base, the real bases, is what is, I think, decisive in answering the other two questions.
You start off with categories as concepts. I don't understand that. You start off with your experience of your experiencing and your understanding of your experiencing and your understanding and so on through the process of conversion. The concepts come out of the understanding of those things. I mean, concepts follow understanding. And so you have the insight, yes, he names that an experience because this is what that is. This is understanding. It's distinct from that because this is what that is. And so we have the category understanding.
But what are you understanding? You're understanding the data.
I'm understanding the data of consciousness, but when Lonergan relates the four terms of interiority to research and history and interpretation, history, dialectic, and so on, and for the four special categories, he's linking them to those terms of interiority. But is that not...
Leo, I don't think Danny's saying anything that contradicts what you're saying. The question is how the two bases are related to one another.
Yes.
The base of the general categories is interiorly differentiated consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so the self-appropriation of experiencing, understanding, judging, and deciding. The base of the special categories is religious experience. But how is religious experience related to the structure of intentional consciousness? That's the issue.
Because
the issue is that intentional consciousness is in obediential potency to the reception of the gift. That's the relation between the two. That's the point that he's making. And I think then that the expansion from those bases is going to be analogous to this. And I think you are suggesting at least that analogy. Mm-hmm. expansion.
Are you saying, again, I just want to make sure I got the, clear in my head what the problem is. Are you saying that the experience, which anyone can have, that can give rise to the general category history, for example, or research, you know, everybody can understand what that is. When you get to foundations, and you're saying foundations is a matter of religious experience, well, are we not still talking about the same sort of thing that gives rise to research, except now it is in a person who interprets experience and understands experience and understands and sees the universe, because unless you're a religious person, you can't work in the special categories. Aren't you still talking about experience? Except now it's experience in that larger, or the largest possible context of religious faith. But still, if you're going to talk about it, as Lonergan, say, does in De Dottrino, you're using the general category history, but you're also using it in the context of your understanding of religious experience. And so you're also revealing your foundations.
Okay, it's that, but you're also,
okay, here I am standing here affirming that a relationship between the bases. So I'm using concepts and categories.
Yes.
Okay, but the relationship between the bases is not a matter of concepts and categories. It's a matter of relationship of this reality to that reality.
But they're not separate realities. I mean, they're distinct.
Well, I'm not saying, well, I mean...
Okay. But I mean, in practice...
They're obviously distinct.
But are we talking about someone in practice actually using method in explicating an actual theological problem using both sets of categories?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're talking about?
And how do you avoid, for instance, how does a contemporary theology avoid a method of correlation that will collapse grace into nature? And a lot of them do, okay? It collapses it. The special, the realities named by the special categories into the realities named by the general categories.
So doesn't the problem...
Or on the other hand, how do you avoid a fideism that neglects all general categories as being unimportant?
Then wouldn't the solution, part of it at least, lie in identifying the creative relations at extra, the supernatural relations
That's precisely what he's doing, and saying...
But he didn't mention any of those.
He did. Have you read the paper?
Yeah.
The mission of the Spirit? Is it?
Yes.
All right. That's what he's talking about. What is the relation of the mission of the Spirit to the human, to the thrust of the human spirit as attentive, intelligent, reasonable, reasonable?
I didn't.
It's a relationship of obediential potency from below to receive the mission of the Spirit.
Yes. Well, then, I mean, he didn't use the language of the four participations in the four, and that's why I didn't twig on that. So there seems to me then the nexus of the problem is we have to be able to line up, as it were, each of those participations with the terms of relations of interiority.
Yeah, but see, that's a further question. You see, if you there was, when I started this, another section to this paper with the title God's Actuation of Our Obediential Potency, in which I was going to try to go into that.
He talks about that in DDT, by the way, if you didn't.
Yeah, but you see, the trouble is that the paper was just too long. It was too long as it is, so I just cut it.
So now the problem now is much clearer to me. Like I said when I began my remarks, I have to get used to your way of talking about this because I'm thinking about the same sort of things in different vocabulary.
Just to put a further spin on it, a historical version of what I think is, if not the same problem, but I suggested it's the same problem, but it's the dispute grew out of the writings of Etienne Gilson in the 30s and the 40s. The issue was framed as, is there a Christian philosophy? And the issue that was front and center in that long-standing discussion was whether the claims of you know, the Christian believer ultimately his or her articulation of the claims of revelation can be how can they be brought into philosophy without changing philosophy into theology? The for whatever it's worth, the stance on that that seemed to me to be the most accurate way, or the, you know, the best solution would be to persons would speak of an external psychological influence of revelation upon philosophy, but not an intrinsic or essential substantive influence. Corresponding to your example of creatio ex nihilo, a ultimately a revelational claim as having all sorts of really interesting philosophic import parallel to that. The one that looms large in Gilson's writings is, you know, you're probably aware, is the column of you know, perhaps even a false translation or bad translation of Exodus 3:14. Ego sum qui sum, I am who am. Gilson goes on at great length to argue that that translation, perhaps even mistranslation of a scriptural text was key in Aquinas' elaboration of the philosophic notion of God as octus purus. So just a historical thing to contextualize it in a way that adds an additional perspective.
So what we're really talking about is really a development of the psychological analogy, really what it comes down to, if we're going to talk about the way in which...
Not just a development, it's the relations between the human analogate and the divine procession. How are they related to one another?
Yes. There's a lot of clues in DDT.
Just a question on the special categories, special theological categories. As I was reading your paper, I was thinking of, well, you know, being in love with God and so on. What about, you know, an atheist and, you know, a greater part of our world that has no connection with God, and no belief in God? You know, we seem to presume in the special categories that here is a person who is in, you know, a believing person who's in touch with God and so on. So, but does it only apply to people like that, or you know, what do we do with hundreds, thousands, millions of atheists in our world? So they can operate on the other dimensions of but they don't seem to have that interest or companion, much less capacity to initiate or to enter into the special categories.
I think if you first off, if you talk about theologians who adopt such a position, and there are some, you end up with Cuppet, I think is his name, Don Cuppet, or you end up with a very weird theology, and it really is an instance in which all special theological categories are collapsed into some form of general categories. Now, if you're talking in a more general way about whether or not the people who claim to be atheists are really such. There is that remark in Lonergan that there are lots of people who can deny God in their heads, but not in their hearts. And, you know, there are lots of psychic aspects to all of this. I mean, when I alluded to the post-Copernican homelessness that afflicts the Western psyche, I think I was thinking about that. I mean, you take someone like Carl Sagan. Now, there was a man who was religious in spite of himself. You know, he had all the emotions connected with religions, but he directed it towards the universe. His partner just wrote an article in a periodical called Skeptical Inquiry about, you know, whether or not she'd ever see him again, and she was quite adamant that she would never see him again, and the only thing she could fall back on were her memories of their time together. You know, people like another man, Stephen Jay Gould. You know, there was a man who was religious in spite of himself, in spite of all of his denials. Now, you know, people can just be just so confused about it. They can be. There are lots of psychic. You know, in the West, we labor under the Enlightenment, the wars of religion, a whole slew of developments out of that. That make it very difficult for people to sort of appropriate a belief in God unless they find themselves in certain circumstances. But belief in God somehow bubbles up in some form or other.
I would add to that the distinction between the gift as conscious and the gift as known. And I think that what Lonergan is talking about is conscious in many, many more people than it's known, than the number of people who are able to name it as anything like the gift of God.
Also,
grace is a reality. If you agree with Lonergan, that's a reality that's offered to all men and women at every time and place. It doesn't have to be named to be lived.
Or being in love with God doesn't have to be emotional either. Because in a number in chapter 20 of Insight, which is by happy coincidence, I just started to go over again about 2 days ago, because I'm dealing with the problem, with the solution to the problem of evil in my dissertation. But with conversations with friends, religious friends, who say, well, how can that be? I don't feel much. I go to church. I do prayer once in a while. I feel kind of close to God. I'm not a very religious person. I'm not in love with God. Yet they live their lives in such a way that they're always working for the good. They're always trying to promote the good of the people around them or the good of their friends. They much rather know the truth than know lies, or they promote. This is all, and Lonergan says in several places in his here and there, that this is all loving God. That's a great consolation to people when they realize that to obey the transcendental precepts, whether or not you are explicitly religious, is to love God.
But I would add to that that there has to be an emotional element that naturally goes with that sooner or later.
Yes, but they mean there's none of that element that they have found in their love for their parents, their children, their spouses, their significant others, that intellectual love, that's often for long periods of time, that is, or even in desolation for long periods of time.
There's a footnote in the paper that I try to sort of talk about. Well, I quoted Francis Thompson's poem about and gloom, you know, where he talks about the gloom he felt, and so, you know, he says, you know, was my gloom after all naught but the shades of his outstretched hand, etc., etc. Now, in this experience, what I'm suggesting is that in the process, there's a Persian carpet intricacy, a surface givenness and a depth givenness. And the surface givenness is very frequently not anything to do with joy or anything positive, but there is underneath it all, and underneath is the wrong word, but you get what I mean, there is still this orientation to God, this fulfillment, and the fulfillment, the natural accompaniment of fulfillment, as Lonergan says, is joy.
I was wondering, you mentioned that the beneficent potency is only accessible to God or can only be moved by God.
Yes.
In terms of evil, I mean, some of the contemporary thought on that is that in some sense evil is almost like a dust, you know. if you go back to Nuremberg, a lot of the bureaucrats who carried out, well, actually, decreed the death of innocent people, they fought to the end that they were doing the right thing because they were directed by the good of the nation and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, in the sense of, if you think of the principalities in Paul, or just the massiveness of evil in the world, what happens to obediential potency? Is it just a non-development if evil grips it, or is it some type of an intrinsic disrailing or destruction? Or like, if it's a philosophical question, why, how can you say that only God can touch it?
Is an obediential potency the kickstart? Just that? God kickstarts our the quickening, I think they used to call it in older language. Isn't that what obediential potency is? We cannot kickstart ourselves. It's just an impossibility.
Oh, I think it's a fulfillment that we're talking about.
Well,
it's the beginning.
The actuation is a fulfillment. The obediential potency in and of itself is just a remote orientation. And that's built into the structure of what it is to be human. The obediential potency, I mean, the natural equivalent to obediential potency, or think of it, if you take away, start again. The natural equivalent is just the natural desire to know God. It's enhanced. That's a natural structure. Lonergan argues that that's a natural structure. But it's just an orientation. It is enhanced in this scheme in virtue of the universe itself from the beginning being orientated to God's self-communication. So it doesn't come along later on. There's no natural potency and obediential potency are not two different things. Mm-hmm.
But the enhancement, can the enhancement not be intrinsically damaged?
You can refuse it, yes.
Okay. The question is around,
see,
evil. You know,
yeah, you see, if you talk about it in an older language and think about it as grace, as sanctifying grace, can you refuse sanctifying grace? Well, yes, you can.
Inauthentic subjects tend to favor counterpositions. So I wondered what you were implying about the vocation of the theologian. Not what position exactly they should take, but what are you saying about the theologian and the theologians, you know, being in love and the positions they take?
Well, you know, it's a it's a disconcerting position that Lonergan is putting forward, I think, really, in the demands that he's making of the theologian. He's really saying that, you know, you can't, it's not enough to be intellectually converted or morally converted. You have to be religiously converted, but even that's not enough. You have to have some understanding of what's going on. And that seems to me, that first set of categories seems to me to be something equivalent to the self-appropriation of our spiritual self-consciousness. And, you know, if you think about it, that's a tremendously demanding position.
So I read it correctly.
Yes.
You mentioned in passing, you know, that we shouldn't exact, well, that he talks about or fledgling lovers or that
yes.
weird language. So that, I mean, it does seem like a very, very high calling, certainly, but also a very demanding position that he's
yeah.
taking. I read that correctly.
Yeah, yes,
yeah.
yes, it, yeah, I
yeah.
think so. And, you know, that business where I try to emphasize the fact that we can use this language of being in love in an unrestricted manner in a way that's that borders on being inauthentic, because we there's a pretense that we've achieved more
yeah.
than we have. And you know, if what he said there, I mean, you know, I don't know whether it was a throwaway remark or not, but if he says that, you know, religious differentiation of consciousness being is approached by the ascetic and attained by the mystic,
yeah.
then, you know, well, yeah, well, where do we stand?
Right. So it does seem like the ideal theologians would be the mystics.
Yeah.
Then, of course, mysticism isn't always about understanding
no,
or
no,
conceptualization.
No. And I don't know whether you remember that remark that he makes in Philosophy of God and Theology, that the trouble with the mystics is they're not really interested in doing this kind of theoretical thinking.
Yeah.
They're beautiful persons, but they're not really interested in this. Well, you've got to end up sometime with the improbable of a mystic and someone interested.
Aquinas at the end of his life.
Yeah, Aquinas at the end of his
life.
Yeah.
I have a question kind of following that one. I was with the talk about atheism and belief in God bubbling up and the responsibility of the theologian. I was wondering about the relationship between, like I recently read from Kangar saying that you can't have fides qua without fides qui, that there's going to be some kind of content to that revelation. And so in terms of authenticity and unauthenticity, the responsibility of the theologian, when I read that footnote there, I thought about maybe theologians that might be pushing a theology that's contrary to church teaching. But for reasons that they see as being like an ethical imperative, you know, Leonardo Boff has a particular understanding, you know, that Jesus Christ came to preach the kingdom and not the church, issues a particular striking challenge. But also, for instance, theologians interested in ecological crisis or interreligious dialogue who would maybe want to emphasize a lower Christology than a higher Christology that gets to the real heart of, you know, incarnation and Trinity maybe. Maybe she could just respond to that. I know it's.
Are you assuming, just a question for clarification, are you assuming that what you refer to as the teaching of the church itself is invariably authentic?
Oh, well, I'm not sure about that, but I think that there's definitely room for self-criticism there. But I think that there are certain, the reason I brought up the incarnation Christology is because I think that the incarnation and Trinity are kind of like central dogmatic matters that, in terms of your paper, obediential potency is like, you see that as the link, and so like the takeaway to compromise the incarnation is to like throw into question a very our understanding of all of this. So then we're talking about belief in God, our idea of, you know, you're understanding your papers that everybody can kind of realize this. This is the nature of the universe, is that we're ordered towards God, to receiving God.
Mm-hmm.
What about someone who has a different Christology, where that's thrown into question? Is that an unauthentic response to who they actually are? And what if they're doing this out of what they see as an authentic response to the contemporary situation? Do you know what I'm saying? Kind of.
You mean how does the difference show up?
Well,
is there a theology that they're at odds with?
Well, it's. I guess maybe I just had hairs raised up on the back of my neck a little bit, because I see how it might be consistent, or maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but there are a lot of good people that might express different Christologies, and it's like, I'm not sure if I'm prepared to say, you know, you're unauthentic. Maybe that's not what you're saying. But then if not, how does that relationship between to focus the discussion, fides quam, fides quae. What is that relationship?
Could you sort of specify an alternate Christology so that I can get an idea of what you mean?
Well, like Jesus is a mystic. He wasn't the the incarnation. Wasn't the self-revelation of the Word, but it was a guy who really figured it out and wants to lead us to realize within ourselves the same thing, something of the same thing.
Well, a position like that, in a sense, I think sort of undercuts a lot of the presupposition that operate in the paper. I'd have to say that. You do away with the Trinity to start off with, because you have no need of the Trinity. It ends up being a different kind of discussion. I mean, a discussion like this just doesn't. It can't go forward with such a different Christology. I mean, it can't go forward if you say that, well, Jesus was an itinerant cynic.
Sure.
Who wandered around for a while in Palestine. We think he got crucified, but maybe he didn't, and then he was eaten by dogs.
So from that understanding, that's an excellent image there. From the understanding of your paper, when you hear of a theologian who's expounding these kinds of views, how do you understand that? Like, they've been offered grace. From your understanding, they've been offered grace. Have they received it?
I'm not in a position to judge.
Well, I know you're not in a position to judge, but is that an indication of unauthenticity when you say that there's a responsibility of a theologian to become this mystic, and that has a noetic dimension? There's a real, there's a cognitive status to our creedal and doctrinal affirmations, that we can even say that we grasp in faith, or that the Church grasps in faith with authority, the incarnation and the Trinity.
You see, I suppose it's possible that someone could be religiously converted and not intellectually converted or morally converted. And so that a lot of the things that they come up with when they operate intellectually are skewed.
Would you want to add also from doctrinal pluralism? Lonergan has that thing of saying, they might not be converted either intellectually or morally or religiously, but then also there's differentiation of consciousness and the lack of it.
Yes.
So, remember, he has all those different possible positions.
Yes.
And what we have to figure out is, does this come from, say, a different culture?
Yeah.
Or from differentiations of consciousness or their lack? Or does it come from the lack of intellectual and moral and religious conversion, and all those different possibilities.
Yeah.
So one couldn't surely be a theologian who is religiously converted or even morally and intellectually converted but doesn't have a differentiation of consciousness about something, or at least not intellectually.
Following that up, I mean, he gives an example in Method and Theology of Danilu's account of the Jewish Christologies, where the best they could come up with within the confines of their conceptuality was that Jesus was an angel, and he says that wasn't really a non-orthodox position. It was the best that they could come up with in that context.
I was just going to add that if I understand Chris's question there, that you kind of dealt with that on the paper when you went on to the dialectic, that this is dialectic functions at a certain time to distinguish, what is positions and counterpositions, even though someone may be, religiously converted.
Yeah.
There's that step. That's what helped me in understanding the question.
And dialogue as well. Lonergan's got something in his later post-method stuff, but beyond dialectic is dialogue, and that dialogue is encounter, is the place where the grounds can get opened up for all of this as people reveal themselves to one another. It takes a long time sometimes find out where somebody's really coming from, where their explicit formulations are around them. It's getting to know your interlocutor as well.
I guess one thing that comes to mind is just connecting what you're talking about to what many people talk about when they're talking about spirituality. And I'm just aware that there's a lot of interest in the medical world about spirituality and the importance of that. But everybody who talks about it seems to be talking about something different, thinking of that differently. One thing that I came across recently was an article by Tad Dunn talking about spirituality in the care of the dying. And he gives a little bit of a definition of spirituality as something beyond reason. You know, that it's something that we're drawn to something beyond reason. And I'm just wondering if there's any connection between what you're talking about, nature and grace. I think a lot of people, when they're talking about spirituality, it's somehow connected to, you know, a notion of the transcendent, something connected with experiences of grace, whatever. But is there a way that you could kind of, you know, well, this discussion you're having can be connected to how the average person is using the term spirituality?
I don't know, Bill. Surely says, you know, something beyond reason, in your terms, something beyond rationalism.
Yeah, something, yes. I guess, you know, that it's important that there's a certain obscurity that is maintained when people talk about spirituality. And that might connect with the fact that it is, you know, that it's beyond reason. You know, there is a, you know, they can experience a pull, but they don't know where they're being pulled to. And maybe all that's necessary for lots of people is just the fact that somehow they're being pulled by a sense of wholeness or whatever. And maybe that's all that's possible in their particular situation.
One of the other things that he says that is kind of interesting is that to actually start talking to people about these, about the spiritual, and to be kind of importing notions of faith, hope, and love, you talk about spiritual issues. So for hope, you talk about aesthetics. What is it that draws them? What do they find beautiful? And that gets you into the spiritual.
Yeah, but I mean, what do you do in a situation where, you know, with the kind of situation which you deal where it's end of life, those kinds of considerations, I think, no longer carry the force that they might on an earlier period. You know, there has to be, in those situations, a deeper kind of discussion. And if the person can only talk about something like, you know, I'm connected to the universe somehow, and there's a sense of wholeness there, and that's as far as they can go, then maybe that's all that, you know, someone like a physician or someone talking about spirituality can offer to them.
I think a lot of these questions are related to what you have to say about the first set of special categories, that it's demanding a new theology of spiritual formation. You don't have the language to answer some of these. We're doing the best we can with the language that we have.
You know, I was listening a couple of nights ago to a man on the radio, Christopher Alexander by name, who is an architect. And he was talking about sort of, you know, buildings with living buildings, and he got around to talking about God, and he said, well, I used to be a Catholic, but I don't really connect with it anymore, but I talk about, you know, sort of the universe or wholeness. Wholeness was his central term. And, you know, there's a kind of living wholeness that you can find in some buildings and you don't find in other buildings. And and he sort of expands this. You know, he's got this four-volume work, The Nature of Order, and all of this. But it's it's not Catholic spiritual language. But, you know, it's not sort of totally diverse either.
I thought you were going to talk about the architect encounter that you were involved with over the past week at Beth Sedek.
You must have some idea in your mind. Maybe you should.
this person went to a talk by Daniel Libeskind about his work as an architect in Beth Sedek. I'm giving a secondhand report here. He seemed to have quite a keen sense of presence and be quite able to recognize instances of spirit along with total absence of vocabulary to talk about it. So the last question that the rabbi asked him about, perhaps you could recount that. The rabbi said, what is it that distinguishes a Jewish religious worship context from other contexts?
And especially for the future now. But he did use the imagery of light. He said it went. And the light just sort of fills the space and it all comes together. That's it. So that was his way of speaking. And the computer had broken down, so he'd been deprived of the opportunity to show images. So he could only use words, which was interesting. So for him, perhaps the way to express his understanding was much more through image. But that had been taken away, so the words about light were his alternative.
But the words that he offered didn't completely satisfy the rabbi who raised the question.
No. He sat down in puzzlement.
Page 29 here, you speak of the vertical finality or the stratified adventure. A natural orientation or order among lower strata for the reception of a fulfilling term from some higher strata. I suppose the case in question would be our obediential potency in relation to God. Is there any other case where there would be some kind of potency of a lower nature for the reception of a fulfilling term from a higher nature which would be parallel to that?
Well, it wouldn't be obediential potency because potency is always the fulfillment always comes out through the agency of God. But vertical finality is there are many instances of vertical finality. Wherever there's an aggregate that's systematized at a higher level, then you have an instance of vertical finality. In finality, love, and marriage, he goes into it a little bit. What's necessary for vertical finality is plurality at a lower level. And that, if that plurality is integrated at some higher level, like chemicals in relationship to biology, then you have an instance of vertical finality. But none of those are instances of obediential potency.
Can I ask a question that takes us right back to the beginning again, as to a puzzling number? But you were saying with some excitement that you see in Danny's proposal the solution to a nagging problem. Could you say just a little more about how you see it as the solution? Why obediential potency is that way that you are now able to see the possibility of bringing together what is peculiar to religion, what is peculiar to, well, perhaps in the largest context.
Leo, could I just mention, Obediential potency is not in any way a novel notion.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to situate it in
yeah.
that context.
Okay.
I've never thought of it in that context.
Yeah.
And I know Rahner talks a lot about obediential potency. It's
yeah.
not in the notion. I had it as a MD student. In fact, someone, I have to go back and find this book review. Someone wrote a book review, and I believe it was Bernie Terrell from Gonzaga, who says explicitly that that used to be called obediential potency, but now because of Lonergan, it is now called this. He actually says that in the book review. And it might have been his review of Stebbins, but I'm not sure. I'm going to go back and find it. Because he does juxtapose
the what used to be called obedience.
He said, well, Rahner calls obediential potency. There's no, given what Lonergan's position, it's no longer necessary for us to talk about obediential potency because Lonergan has said this.
Well, Lonergan talks about obediential potency.
Mm-hmm.
That Danny's paper draws from.
Yes, but I'm saying Bernie Terrell says this explicitly. And it would be interesting to find out exactly what it was. But this is about 5 years ago. So my memory has
yeah,
faded
sure
a little.
In terms of your question, this might be more relevant.
Yeah. The trouble is that the language of obediential potency is easily used, but you know, Lonergan is the only person I know who actually went into it and talked about it in terms of passive potency, essential passive potency. It's remote. It's not proximate. He is the only person I know that has actually done that. And while the term is frequently comes up, at least in Catholic theology, I don't know of anyone who has this precise idea of it. Now, I would be very reluctant to dispense with it and say that something else will do for it. When we haven't even sort of grasp what it meant in the first place.
But now that you have grasped what it means, could you be a little more explicit about how it is the key to solving the problem, the larger problem that you talk about? Why is that so? In other words, there's something missing, and now this has provided what is missing. Is that
okay? The question that Humani Jainer has had about the gratuity of grace seemed to have the implication that grace came as something tacked on to the world, to the universe.
Yes.
So we end up with a kind of two-story universe where God's self-communication is extrinsic. It doesn't relate to us intrinsically. And, you know, Lonergan seems to suggest that Cajetan was the originator of this idea when he denied that there was a natural orientation to know God. And what I'm suggesting is you either have to go with the two-story universe or you have to go with obediential potency. And I don't see that there are any other options, and I don't want to go with the two-story universe.
Yes, I mean, we're all going with obediential potency. That's Kathy's been doing that for a long time. My question is still, why does that make a difference in trying to bring together nature? Let me change the language for a moment. When we talk about general categories and religious categories, can we change that terminology and say nature and grace? Is that what they reduce to? Is that what the real problem is? How do nature and grace relate? So if you have a theoretical foundation through obediential potency to show how nature and grace, then you have a means upon which you can say
yeah.
to the philosopher.
But you see, the trouble with the language of nature and grace is that they belong to theoretical theology.
Yes.
And they don't belong to a methodical
theology.
And that's the whole point. That here, what Lonergan is saying is, you transpose sanctifying grace and you reconceptualize it as being in love in an unrestricted manner. Now the point about that is it's conscious, whereas a lot of the conceptuality connected with grace, it was unconscious, and it was explicitly argued that it was unconscious.
Yes.
And it was just another example of this kind of extrinsicism.
But let's just say all that has been solved now. Grace and freedom more or less solves the problem of the two worlds, really, of the two-story universe, whatever you want to call it. But I was looking for, rather than complicated by saying this set of categories, that set of categories, if we want to get a kind of a that base upon which everything else is going to be built methodically. Mm-hmm. And like
I
say,
what I was trying to get at in the remark that I made there was in light of a lot of the contemporary discussions of the method of correlation. They don't use the language of general categories and special categories.
Right.
They use the language of the situation and the tradition. So David Tracy, for instance, will talk about criteria of appropriateness to the tradition. And criteria of intelligibility in the situation. And then you correlate the conceptualities there. Now, and a number of people might be tempted to say that what Lonergan's talking about as general categories are what Tracy's talking about as situation. And what Lonergan's talking about as special categories are what Tracy's talking about as tradition. But that's not true, because the general and special categories are both used in the interpretation of the tradition,
yes,
and in the notion of and in the assessment of the contemporary situation. And so he's pulling you to a more radical basis by getting you to the bases of intentionality and grace, the gift of God's love as the basis for the categories rather than tradition and situation. But he doesn't answer the question how those categories are related to each other. And I've tried to work that out, and I haven't come up with an answer until I read this, that they're related to each other in along the lines of the obediential potency of the basis. I think that's the key to the issue.
So
with that comment, I think we're the discussion can continue. We should thank the respondent and presenter.